saw the glow on Tekla's face, the highlights on the lenses of her eyes. Did the Russians even use the same Morse code as Americans? Tekla had to know it. She was a pilot. Dinah made the light flash with the dots and dashes for Morse. Tekla nodded, and Dinah could see her mouth making the word da. Dinah signaled, "Do you need anything?" The faintest trace of a smile came over Tekla's lips. It was not a warm kind of smile, more bemused. She held up what was left of the chocolate bar and pointed to it. Dinah returned, "Tomorrow." Tekla nodded, then she turned away, her buzz-cut blonde hair glinting in the light of the LEDs, and drifted back to the middle of her onion. 5% was how Ivy began the next meeting in the banana. It was full to capacity. The original 12-person crew of Izzy, the five who had come up on the Soyuz on A+0.17, and Igor, the scout who had come in from the cold when his suit had failed. He, Marco, and Gibran had prepped for the meeting by jury-rigging some fans to blow more air through the space so it wouldn't fill up with carbon dioxide. This had prompted Dinah to joke that perhaps all meetings should take place in hermetically sealed rooms so that they could only go on for so long. No one, with the possible exception of Reese, had seen it as funny. Anyway, the roar of ventilation was even louder than it usually was in space, and so Ivy had to speak up and use her big boss voice. "This is day 37, Ivy went on. "That's 10% of a year. If it's true that we had 2 years from zero to the hard rain, then we have already burned through 5% of the time during which we can expect to receive any help from Earth. 5% of the time needed to turn this installation into a society and an ecosystem that is sustainable indefinitely." Ivy was standing with her back to the big screen, so she couldn't see the reaction of the architects down below, in some conference room at the other end of the video link. For today's meeting, there were three of them. Scott, Sparky, Spaulding, who was still the administrator of NASA, Dr. Pete Starling, the president's science advisor, and Ulrika Eck, a Swedish woman who had worked as a project manager for one of the private commercial space startups until recent events had forced a career change. She was now coordinating the activities of several different space agencies and private companies as they worked on the Cloud Arc. Apparently, she had become the architect-in-chief. Apparently being the key word, since every time Dinah had any contact with the ground, she was reminded of how little she understood of what was happening there. On one level, she was one of the luckiest people in the human race. She was going to get to stay alive. At the same time, she and the others got very little information from the planet and had to piece things together from a jumble of clues. She had compared notes on this with Ivy, who had confirmed that even she had little to go on, and what she did hear contradicted itself from hour to hour. It had all become Kremlinology. Back in the heyday of the Soviet Union, the only way for Westerners to guess what was going on there was to look at the lineup of dignitaries on Lenin's tomb in the May Day parade and riddle it out from the seating chart and who shook hands with whom. Now Dinah was doing the same thing with these three faces on the screen. Sparky was no use. He'd spent so much time in space that he had developed a kind of thousand light-year stare. He was famous for being oblivious to the political side of things. His opposite in that respect was Pete Starling. Pete's job was to mutter scientific explanations into the president's ear. He'd been doing rather a lot of it in the last 37 days. He had a background running big science programs at universities, climbing the ladder from Mankato State to Georgia Tech to Columbia to Harvard in a mere 10 years. Why was he sitting in on this meeting? There was little he could contribute. He must be here as the eyes and ears of JBF. But why should JBF care? No decisions were going to be made here. It was just a status report, a check-in. As soon as Ivy finished her sentence, the corners of Pete's mouth turned down. He looked at Ulrika Eck, a somewhat matronly woman in her late 40s, extremely good at her job, according to Reese. On the high-def video feed, Dinah saw the slightest deflection of her eyes, noticing the turn of Pete Sterling's head, but not exactly acknowledging it. Ulrika clearly didn't like him, but there was a reason she was a well-regarded project manager. "Ivy," she said, "just for clarity, when we speak of this installation, we're using the term in an elastic sense, of necessity." Ivy turned to look at the screen. "Installation probably isn't the right word," she admitted, "since it's not installed anywhere." Pete Sterling spoke up. "I believe that where Ulrika is going is that the cloud arc is a fluid concept that may paradigm shift beyond recognition as we proceed adaptively through the next 95% of the timeline." Ivy's brow furrowed. Something was going on, some kind of political tussle down on the ground. It was important to people like Pete.
"This is not efficient use of time," Fyodor said. "I am working to extend trust receive pioneers."
Fyodor's English was excellent, but when he was annoyed, as he was now, he dropped his articles.
"I have 8 suits outside, 5 inside, for unlucky number of 13.
It had become common to use a form of synecdoche in which suit denoted a person qualified to perform extravehicular activities who is equipped with a spacesuit that still works.
"Pioneers arrive in 2 weeks. This is still true? Then I need more scouts yesterday, as saying goes."
When Fyodor had come up to Izzy 6 months ago, it had been understood as a valedictory mission before getting shunted to an administrator's job at Roscosmos. Not that he hadn't taken his duties seriously, but he always seemed to be taking the long view, perceiving Izzy through the eyes of a future bureaucrat who would need to make it run smoothly until his retirement. That had all changed on Zero, of course. It had changed even more with the Russian invasion. No new rank or title had been bestowed on Fyodor. None was needed. All the Russians just accepted him, implicitly and without question, as their leader. And his manner had changed accordingly. He was scrupulously respectful of Ivy's authority. But there was no question that he was the boss of all things suit-related, and the authority had seemed to make him physically larger and more imposing, his creased face tougher, his voice firmer. Sparky answered him.
"Fyodor, that fuel pump has been fixed. It was just a bad sensor. So the launch is going up as scheduled."
He checked his wristwatch, did a mental calculation.
14 hours from now. 6 hours after that, you'll have your suits.
And the zavods, and the vestibules. The things I mentioned.
We have had teams of engineers working on those fixes around the clock, Fyodor. I am very worried about door-closing mechanisms."
The remainder of the meeting had to do with the pioneers who would start coming up in another 2 weeks, and who would live, for the time being, in rigid or inflatable habitats more accommodating than Luke's. These would be docked along a series of pressurized tubes, little different in principle from the big spiral-wound ventilation ducts seen in warehouses, that would ramify outward from attachment points in the truss. Little of it concerned Dinah, and so her attention drifted to her laptop. She had other things she could be working on, and Ivy's reminder about the 5% had not left her in the mood to wool-gather during a long meeting. Most of her work of late had been on ice crawlers, and, as of the most recent shipment, ice tunnelers. But she had resolved that she would not shut down her progress on the iron mining robots. Even if she only spent 15 minutes a day on them, it was better than suspending work altogether. She was afraid that if she ever did that, the entire project would disappear. To that end, she kept a window open in the lower left corner of her screen, showing video from Amalthea. Mostly the point-of-view cameras of robots that were actually doing things. It was always there in her peripheral vision as she attended to email and scheduling spreadsheets and Gantt charts. And at some point, she noticed something that wasn't quite right. A few minutes later, she noticed it again and put her other work on hold. She expanded the window and took control of the robot that was transmitting the video. She swiveled its camera around until she had a view of the thing that had been bothering her. It was Tekla, floating in her Luke. She was bright blue, which meant that she had donned her cooling garment. That was normal. She did it every day as she got ready for her shift. The next step should have been to squirm feet first through Luke's flange into the vestibule. But she wasn't doing that. She was going back and forth between the vestibule and the middle of the Luke. She would go through the flange head first, which was abnormal, and do something for a minute or two, then withdraw into the Luke and thumb away on her tablet for a while. She was late. Every other day she'd been in her suit and out on the truss by this time. Dinah wasn't the only person who had become distracted by her laptop. Fyodor, normally not a fan of email and other such modern diversions, was watching his screen too, occasionally making eye contact with the equally distracted Maxime, who kept making a gesture like tugging at an imaginary beard. Something was wrong. What had Fyodor said? I am very worried about door-closing mechanisms. He wasn't just saying that in the abstract. He was referring to a specific situation. He was talking about Tekla. Tekla could clamber from her Luke through the vestibule and into her suit, but she couldn't close the door behind her back. She needed the mechanism for that. If it didn't work, then she couldn't seal the suit, and if the suit wasn't sealed, she was trapped inside her OVL, as they had taken to calling the combination of the Orlan suit with the vestibule and the Luke. It was not exactly an emergency, but it was bad. In order to get mail, she had to detach her suit from the vestibule, leaving it open for the delivery to be made in her absence. Mail included food, water, ice, and fresh CO2 scrubber canisters. Dinah didn't know how long Tekla could survive without mail, but she doubted it was more than a day. The heat would get her first. They had to figure out some way to get Tekla inside Izzy, and since the OVL was jury-rigged, it didn't have a docking port like a normal spacecraft. There was no hatch, no way of mating to an airlock. She studied Fyodor's face through the rest of the meeting, which went on for another half hour, and began to understand something. He was getting ready to sacrifice Tekla. Ready in the sense of emotionally hardening himself to that reality. Dinah understood no email now. It was simply part of being a scout that you would probably not survive. And if you knew you were going to be sacrificed, it wouldn't help matters to be spamming the scout email list with pleas for help and goodbye messages. Tekla could communicate with Fyodor, and Fyodor only, and that was for a reason. It was a reason that the defenders of Leningrad, Stalingrad, and Moscow would have understood and accepted perfectly well. But it was a little bit out of step with the modern ethos. Correction. With the modern ethos as it had existed during the age of the One Moon. It was perfectly in step with how things were now. Part of her wanted to go and plead with Fyodor to mount a dramatic and heroic rescue mission. There had to be a way to make it happen. They had all seen Apollo 13. They quoted lines of dialogue from it all the time. But she already knew the answer. The pioneers would begin arriving, shiploads of them, in 2 weeks. All of them would die on arrival if the correct preparations had not been made. No time could be spared. More scouts were on the way to replace Tekla. And for once, she was glad that the meeting ran long, that Sparky didn't stick to the agenda, and that Pete Starling exploited it to fill time with more buzzwords. Because an idea was slowly taking shape in her head. She would have to run it by Ivy and Reese, and perhaps Marco. She would want to have Margie Coughlin, the closest thing they had to a doctor, standing by, but she could do it with no help at all from Fyodor or any of the other suits. Fyodor was typing something with his index fingers. She locked her eyes on his face and kept them there until he was finished. He seemed to have detected her gaze on him, because he then looked up and stared straight into her eyes, maintaining a perfect poker face. She stared back. Awareness crept into Fyodor's expression. Awareness that Dinah knew about the problem. Fyodor knew the layout of Izzy better than anyone. He knew where Dinah spent her time, and that Dinah only had to look out her window to see what was going on. She could see him putting this all together in his head. He was expecting her to make some emotional appeal, so it was important for her to stay cool. As soon as she turned on the waterworks, she would lose his respect and his attention forever. "Fyodor," she said, "I got this." He blinked in surprise, then, after some hesitation, made the tiniest of nods.
"Got what?"
Pete Starling asked over the video link.
"Am I missing something?"
"No," Dinah said. "We are just proceeding adaptively to leverage our core competencies." Based on stats from the 50 Hottest Olympians website, Ivy was a fairly close match for Tekla physically. Tekla was huskier, but Ivy was an inch taller. So the first thing they did was to stuff Ivy into the small airlock that Dinah used for her robots. With her head tucked and her knees drawn up to her chest, she fit into it with room to spare. Dinah took a picture, then appended it to an email message with detailed instructions. Spencer Grindstaff, who, as a young CIA contractor, had cut his teeth hacking into email systems operated by foreign governments, figured out a way to send email to Tekla's tablet by wrapping it in an envelope that made it look like it came from Fyodor. Dinah watched Tekla read that email. She looked up from the tablet toward the window, then turned her gaze toward the airlock. Until then, Dinah had worried that Tekla might be losing consciousness, since she hadn't moved in several hours. She guessed that Tekla was trying to conserve oxygen and reduce thermogenesis by moving as little as possible. Dinah zip-tied a high-powered LED light to the inner hatch of the airlock, then closed it. She opened the valve that dumped its air into space, allowing it to fill up with vacuum, and then actuated the lever, a simple mechanical linkage, that flipped the outer hatch open. She could see the white glow of the LED reflecting against the plastic of Tekla's Luke bubble a few meters away, and she saw Tekla's head turn as the light got her attention. Several robots had to act in concert to move Tekla's Luke bubble around until it was pressed against the airlock. This was a somewhat maddening process, like trying to grab an inflated balloon with a pair of needle-nosed pliers. Dinah had been trying to do it with Psywise, Sidewinders, of which she now had a dozen in operation. A Psywai could join head-to-tail with another Psywai to double its length, and the process could be repeated indefinitely to construct a sort of smart, instrumented tentacle. By planting the tail of one Psywai against Amalthea and bolstering the connection by holding it down with a couple of anchored grabs, she was able to make another Psywai slither up to the first and connect to its head, which was projecting up into space. A third Psywai climbed up the first two and concatenated itself, and so on and so forth. Building a stalk that reached up from the surface of the asteroid and began to curve around the bubble in which Tekla was imprisoned. So far so good, but the longer the chain grew, the worse it behaved. The Psywais were constructed like caterpillars, consisting of many identical segments connected by flexible joints. The joints were motorized, and the motors were supposed to follow commands embedded in Dinah's code, and was all supposed to work in a predictable way. The problem was that each joint had a bit of flexibility, which, as far as Dinah was concerned, was error. Those errors accumulated as the length of the chain grew, so that by the time she had connected three Psywise together, she found it difficult to know, let alone control, the position of the end of the stalk. and when she tried to apply force by making the chain curve around the slippery, bulgy surface of the Luke, matters only got worse. Rhys showed up a few hours into the project and watched. He'd be silent for hours, then suddenly ask a question that was strangely off-kilter and yet showed he was thinking about the problem.
"What if you turned all the motors off and let the whole thing go slack?"
he asked. "Aren't you supposed to be building a Taurus?" she demanded, and turned around to give him her best attempt at a killing look.
"First, we have to solve this problem," he said gently.
She had more to say, but instead she went silent. Rhys was clowning around with his necklace again. He was in the habit of wearing a chain around his neck. Nothing fancy or bulky. Just a simple loop of twisted link jewelry chain in stainless steel, which he used as a way to keep thumb drives and other important small objects from floating away. At the moment, though, he had removed all of that stuff, leaving the chain unencumbered, and he had got it spinning around his neck. It had opened up into a broad, undulating oval that didn't touch his neck or collar anywhere, so it was just orbiting around him in free space. Dinah had seen him do this before, typically while bored in meetings. He had learned a few tricks for speeding it up and coaxing it into different shapes by blowing on it with a drinking straw or flicking it with a fingernail. It didn't form a perfect circle, as one might expect. The moving train of links could be molded into almost any shape and would stay that way until disturbed. When Dinah turned around and noticed he was doing it again, she was about to roll her eyes and say something like, "For fuck's sake, can't you do anything useful with that brain?" But the look on Rhys's face suggested that he was up to something more than just playing around. The chain had been running in an elongated racetrack shape, nearly buzzing his neck on one turn, but he flicked at the straightaways and broadened it into something approaching a circle, then ducked out of it, leaving the loop spinning in midair.
"Channeling the wisdom of my ancestors, if you must know," he said.
"You had ancestors in zero-G."
"Alas, no. My great-great-great-great-uncle, John Aitken, was an eccentric Victorian meteorologist with an even more eccentric hobby. Studying the physics of moving chains. Unfortunately for him, he had to do it in his drawing room in Falkirk, where there is, I'm sorry to say, gravity. He had to approximate this sort of thing."
Rhys nodded at the whirring loop of chain.
"By building exceedingly clever machines."
"Then he must have been a clever man indeed."
"Fellow of the Royal Society and friend of Lord Kelvin, since you mentioned it. Do you see where I'm going?"
"Well, a minute ago you gave me a fat clue by suggesting that I turn off all the motors in the Sci-Y train. Were I to do that, it would go completely limp and become, for all practical purposes, a length of chain."
"Yes,"
Rhys drawled, and poked an index finger up into the chain's path. It caught on his knuckle, hiccuped, and suddenly wrapped around his hand in a chaotic tangle. "That's confidence-inspiring," Dinah said.
"Hold on. It turns out that my Uncle John knew a few things, and later on, another chap, name of Kucharski, in Berlin, worked on this stuff too."
Rhys was untangling the chain, looking for its clasp. When he found it, he undid it, converting the chain from a loop into a segment about as long as his arm.
"Unfortunately, there's gravity in Berlin, too, so we had to do stuff like this on tables. Hold it right there, would you please?"
And he got Dinah to pinch the middle of the chain between her fingers, keeping it fixed in space. From there, he drew the two ends back toward himself, forming the chain into a skinny, elongated U.
"You can let go now, gently."
Dinah released the chain and allowed herself to float back from it, since Rhys had taken on something of the air of a magician in performance. He let go of one of the ends, kept the other grasped between his thumb and index finger.
"What happens if I pull?" he asked. "Any predictions?"
"The whole thing will move back toward you, I guess."
"Let's try it. Hold your finger up just there."
Dinah pointed up and allowed Rhys to reach out with his free hand and grasp her gently by the wrist, arranging her hand so that the finger was several inches away from the vertex of the U-shaped bend in the chain.
"Here goes nothing," he said,
and began to pull the chain toward him, away from Dinah. Contrary to what she'd expected, the bend started to propagate away from Rhys and toward Dinah, until finally the free end hurtled around like a whip cracking and made several quick turns around her finger, snaring her.
"Gotcha," he said,
and began pulling her toward him. "Just like a bullwhip," she observed, unwinding the chain from her finger too late to avoid being drawn into close, cozy contact with Rhys.
"It is exactly the same physics," he confirmed. "Kucharski called that thing, the traveling U-shaped bend, a Knickstelle. It means something like kink place."
"Chains, whips, and now kinks? I'm learning so much about your Victorian ancestors, Rhys."
"You probably thought this was a mere diversion," he said.
"Oh, no, I see your point. Rather than trying to control the Siwai chain like a tentacle, all clenching muscles, let it relax and whip around the Luke like a smart chain." This little digression into 19th century physics turned out to be one of those one step back, five steps forward sort of trades. It was the work of a few minutes to concatenate four more Siwais onto the existing chain, then turn off all the motors except a few that she used to fashion a U-shaped bend. Applying tension to one end of it caused the Knickstelle to propagate just as in Rhys's demonstration, so that the end of the chain whipped lazily around the entire circumference of the Luke. Several attempts were required before the grappler at the end of the chain was able to snag a handhold on the far side, but then the Luke was securely captured in the chain's embrace. Grabs could scuttle along it, carrying the ends of cables anchored to other parts of Amalthea, or Izzy, and thus the Luke was gradually ensnared in a loose web of hardware that Dinah used to draw it away from the position where it had been anchored and pull it up snug against the module containing Dinah's shop. As it came closer, the vague nimbus of white light thrown against the Luke by the LED in the airlock narrowed and sharpened and was finally all but snuffed out as the big balloon enveloped the protruding stub of the airlock chamber. The airlock was now poking into the nested layers of the Luke like a finger prodding a balloon. Even after the success of the whip-cracking gambit, this took most of a day. Rhys drifted off, as was his habit. Bo, the Mongolian cosmonaut, slipped into Dinah's shop, observed silently for a couple of hours, and then began finding ways to make herself useful. She learned how to use the data glove and the mouse and keyboard interface just by watching Dinah, and by the end of the day was piloting grabs around and manipulating Siwise like an old hand. Margie Coughlin showed up to watch the final preparations. She was an Australian physiologist who had been sent up to Izzy a few months ago to study the effects of spaceflight on human health. Dinah had always found her a little brusque, but maybe that was just an Australian thing. She brought with her a box of medical supplies and surgical equipment. All the astronauts on the ISS had medical training. Dinah and Ivy had done their time working in Houston emergency rooms, stitching up trauma victims and setting bones. But Margie was the best.
"Not exactly what you signed on for," Dinah said.
"None of us is getting what we signed on for," Margie observed. "With the possible exception of Tekla," said another voice, Ivy's. She was not in Dinah's shop. That was now full with Dinah, Bo, and Margie, but she was in the adjacent scrum.
"Ivy, you ready to set another record?" Dinah asked.
"Ready to try," Ivy said.
This was Q code for the number of women on the space station at one time. The old record had been 4, set in 2010. They had tied it months ago when Margie and Lena had come up to Izzy, joining Ivy and Dinah. They had broken it when Bo had turned up in the Soyuz launch 3 weeks ago. Tekla would make 6, if they could only get her through the airlock. Or the number might drop back if this went wrong.
Beau, thanks for helping. You should probably go out with Ivy.
Good luck,
Beau said, and pushed off from the inner hatch of the airlock, drifted across Dinah's shop and out through the hatch into the scrum, where Ivy hovered waiting.
Everything sealed up behind you?
Dinah asked, more out of nervousness than anything else. It was out of the question that Ivy would get that wrong. Since the breakup of the moon, they'd intensified their precautions anyway, keeping the various modules of Izzy separated by airtight hatches whenever possible, so that the perforation of one module by a bolide wouldn't lead to the destruction of the whole complex. Ivy didn't answer.
You know what to do with that hatch if this all goes sideways,
Dinah went on.
You talk a lot when you're nervous, Ivy said.
I concur, Margie said. Are we going to do this or not? That woman might be asphyxiating out there.
Okay. Giving her the signal now, Dinah said. In the space program that she had dreamed of when she'd been a little girl with a Snoopy the Astronaut poster on the ceiling of her shack in the hinterlands of South Africa, or watching live feeds from the space station on satellite TV in Western Australia, the signal would have been a terse utterance into a microphone or a message struck out on a keyboard. But what she actually did was drift over to her little window and peer through 14 layers of milky translucent plastic at Tekla, almost close enough to reach out and touch and give a thumbs up. Tekla nodded and held up a small object next to her head. It was a folding knife with a belt clip and a lanyard, which she had prudently wrapped around her wrist. Using one thumb, she snapped its serrated blade open. Dinah nodded. Tekla nodded back, then drifted out of view, headed toward the airlock.
Here she comes, Dinah said.
She had already sized Margie up as a woman of some physical strength. She was stocky, but in a powerful rather than a flabby way. Dinah got a grip on the mechanical linkage that would swing the outer hatch of the airlock closed.
Brace me, she said.
She was worried about all that plastic. Shreds of it were certain to get caught in the hatch's delicate seal. The principle was simple enough. She'd run through it in her head 100 times. If Tekla cut a slit, a few inches long, through the innermost layer of the Luke, air would rush out into the space between it and the next layer, which was at a lower pressure. If Tekla put her head and shoulder into that slit, she'd become like a cork in a champagne bottle, and the pressure would try to force her out. If she then cut a slit through the next layer, and the next, a wave of pressure would build up behind her and spit her out like a watermelon seed. And as long as she kept aiming for the white LED on the airlock's inner hatch, she would be projected into that airlock. At that point, she'd be naked and unprotected in the middle of a jet of air that would be exploding away from her into the vacuum. And at that point, there was a whoosh and a meaty, thunking impact.
Jesus Christ! I think that was it, Margie said.
She is out,
Beau confirmed. Beau, out in the next compartment, had a tablet on which she was watching a video feed from a nearby grab.
I mean, she is in the airlock.
Dinah hauled on the handle, swinging the outer hatch closed. Her body, in accordance with Newton's third law, moved in the opposite direction, stealing her force. But Margie's arms caught her in a bear hug and pushed back. Margie had found a way to brace herself.
Beau gasped, "You're smashing her foot!"
"Oh, shit!
Her foot is sticking out!"
"Dinah," Ivy said, "you have to open the hatch a little. Her foot's caught."
Dinah relaxed her arms. What if Tekla was unconscious? What if she was unable to draw herself up into the fetal position they'd shown her in that photograph? The change in Beau's and Ivy's tone told her otherwise.
"She's in!"
Ivy exclaimed.
"Close the hatch! Close it!"
Beau was shouting. Dinah swung the handle all the way around and snapped it into its locked position. It didn't feel quite right, but at least it was closed. Meanwhile, Margie was actuating the valve that let air into the airlock.
This was supposed to be a gradual process, but she just let it go explosively, with a sudden movement of the air that tugged at their diaphragms and popped their ears.
"Blood is coming out," Bo said dully, "leaking out of the hatch."
"Fuck," Dinah said,
because that meant two bad things at once. The outer hatch wasn't really closed, and Tekla was hurt.
"Let's get it open," Margie said.
In the end, it took all four of them, Dinah, Margie, Bo, and Ivy, all crammed into the space with their fingers under the rim of the hatch, pushing against the wall with all the strength in their legs and their backs to break the seal. Whereupon, air whooshed out of the compartment and the hatch flew open like when you finally break the seal on a vacuum-packed jar and the lid flies off. Tekla was in there, drawn up into the prescribed fetal position, a solid mass of red. They all stared at her, speechless for a moment. Her head moved. She turned her face up toward them, revealing a huge red smear where an eye ought to have been. The only thing that kept Dinah from screaming like a little girl was the gorge rising up into her throat. Bo drew in a long breath and began muttering something. Tekla's hands unfolded and gripped the rim of the chamber. The lanyard of the knife was still wound around her wrist. The handle of the knife trailed after it. Dinah supposed that its blade had been snapped off, until she understood that the whole thing had become embedded in Tekla's forearm. Tekla pulled herself out a few inches, then stopped. Her head was now projecting into the room. An eye opened, a bloodshot eye and a bloody face, but a normal, working eye. Dinah's ears began working again, and she realized that she was hearing a loud hissing noise. It was the sound of air escaping from the International Space Station, not through a huge leak, but through small gaps in the airlock's outer seal. The air was flowing past Tekla's body, creating a vacuum behind her, a vacuum she had to fight in order to advance into the room. She felt embarrassed then, in the manner of a hostess who forgets to properly welcome a guest, and she reached down and grabbed one of Tekla's hands. Margie got the other, and with a final sucking, squelching noise, they dragged Tekla's blood-lubricated form out of the airlock chamber and into the space station. Dinah half-closed the inner hatch of the airlock. The big Hoover, as old-school astronauts referred to the vacuum of space, took care of the rest and slammed it closed with frightening violence. They'd lost a measurable percentage of the atmosphere in this module. Not enough to cause oxygen deprivation, but more than enough to set off alarms all over Izzy and all the way down to Houston. Margie got to work on Tekla's arm, which was bleeding quite a lot, while Ivy and Bo, now blue-gloved, cleaned off her face with towelettes. The picture was getting clearer. The basic idea had worked. Tekla's knife work had been true and well-aimed, and perhaps more effective than was really good for her. She had been spat out of the Luke's outermost layer and into the airlock chamber with great force, slamming her face into a metal fitting along the way and opening up big lacerations above and below the eye. These had bled profusely. In the same moment, the blade of her knife had caught on something and turned back on her and been jammed into her forearm. She had lain dazed for a moment, one leg hanging out the open hatch as Dinah had tried to close it on her, then had come to and drawn herself up as planned. For a few moments during all of this, she had been exposed to vacuum, which hadn't done her bleeding wounds any favors. But air had rushed into the lock and equalized the pressure before irreparable damage could be inflicted. As Dinah had worried, scraps of plastic had gotten caught in the outer hatch's gasket, accounting for those hissing air leaks. But most of them drifted off into space when she swung the hatch back open again, and the remaining bits, stuck to the gasket by Tekla's freeze-dried blood, she was able to pick clean using a programmed swarm of gnats. She ended up leaving that project as an exercise for Bo, who was climbing the robot learning curve with remarkable speed. She drifted down the length of Izzy to the hub and thence out to the Taurus, where Margie, getting advice from trauma surgeons down in Houston, was working on Tekla's arm. This was a lot easier in the weak gravity of the Taurus. No globules of blood floating around. Lena Ferreira and June Iueda, both also life scientists, were filling in as assistants. Ivy was in her office fielding a shitstorm of angry reaction from people down in Houston. They were doing the surgery under local anesthesia, so Tekla was awake. They'd cleaned her up and closed the lacerations around her eye socket with butterfly bandages and crazy glue. The silvery blonde stubble that covered her scalp was still darkened with coagulated blood along that side. The whites of her eyes were red, and she had thousands of tiny red marks all over her face. Dinah had been warned to expect those. They were called petechiae. Broken capillaries just under the skin caused by exposure to vacuum. But from the way her eyes moved in their sockets and focused on things, Dinah could see that her vision was basically intact.
"That was uncalled for," Tekla said to her.
"True," Dinah said.
"I shall be in trouble."
"So are we," Dinah said, nodding in the direction of Ivy's office. "We are all in trouble. With a bunch of dead people." Tekla reacted very little, but among Margie and Lena and June, there was a collective intake of breath and a momentary halt in the proceedings.
"Margie," said a Texan voice from the ground, "this dead surgeon would like you to clamp off that arterial before it starts bleeding again."
"Those of us who are going to live," Dinah said, "have to start living by our own lights." Pioneers and Prospectors.
"The Iceman cometh."
"Ah," Rhys sighed.
"I was wondering which of us would be the first to go there."
He pulled out, drifted away, and did a peel and knot on the condom so expertly that it created dark stirrings of jealousy in Dinah's heart. But at least he didn't let anything get loose in Dinah's shop.
"This may have been your last delivery,"
Dinah said. "Of ice, that is.
You've got your freezer.
Coming up on tomorrow's lunch from Kuru.
Any chance of getting them to send up a martini shaker with it?"
"We use plastic bags for that."
"Well, I hope that my deliveries, a voice that is, have contributed something to whatever the hell you've been doing."
"Check this out," she said. She'd already wrapped herself in a blanket, but now she prodded the wall with a toe and drifted over to her workstation. With a bit of clicking around, she brought up a video. The opening shot was stark. A cube of ice in a black chamber, lit up by bright but cold LEDs.
"From Arjuna HQ, I presume?"
Rhys, still naked, came up behind her and wrapped an arm around her waist. She liked to think of it as an affectionate gesture. In part, it was, but she'd been in zero-G long enough to understand that he also just didn't want to drift away while watching the movie.
"Yes."
A bearded strawberry blonde man entered the frame carrying a sheet of corrugated cardboard, the lid of a pizza box.
"That's Lars Hodemaker, I think. One of the guys I've been working with a lot."
Lars angled the pizza lid slightly toward the camera. It was mostly covered by iridescent fingernail-sized objects, like silicon beetles. Hundreds of them.
"That's a lot of gnats,"
Rhys remarked.
"Well, the whole point is to make a swarm."
"I understand. But it seems they found a way to ramp up production."
Lars folded the cardboard diagonally to make it into a crude trough, and then angled it down toward the block of ice. The gnats avalanched down and tumbled onto it in a heap. Quite a few of them skittered off and tumbled onto the floor. Lars exited the frame for a moment, then returned, pushing a wheeled swivel chair. He arranged this behind the block of ice, then disappeared again, then came back carrying a clock that he had apparently just taken down from the wall of an office. He balanced this on the seat of the swivel chair, leaning back against its lumbar support so that it was clearly visible in the frame of the video. Then he departed. A few moments later, the lights got much brighter. "Simulating solar radiation," Dinah explained. "The gnats are solar-powered, so the only way to test them is to have a light source as bright as the sun." The clock's minute hand now began to sweep forward.
Time-lapse?
Rhys asked. Yeah. This stuff happens slowly, as you've seen. The gnats that had scattered to the floor scurried around aimlessly for a bit, then seemed to find the block of ice and scaled its vertical sides. Pretty good adhesion, you'll note, Dinah said. Meanwhile, the heap of gnats on top spread out like a pat of butter softening on a pancake, distributing themselves in a somewhat random but basically even layer atop the ice block. A few of them appeared to sink into the ice.
Melting their way in?
Rhys asked. No, uses too much energy, and wouldn't work in zero-G. They are mechanically tunneling. See the piles forming? She pointed to the top of the ice block, where mounds of white had begun to form around the exits of the tunnels. That is spoil being carved out and ejected by the tunneling gnats.
You can't make mounds in zero-G either,
Rhys pointed out. One thing at a time, she said, elbowing him. The other guys are working on it, see? She used the cursor to point out another gnat that was making its way along the surface. It seized hold of some little ice grains from a mound, then backed away and headed toward the edge of the ice block.
How's it doing that?
Rhys asked. You know how when your hand is wet and you reach into the freezer and pick up an ice cube, it'll stick to your skin? That's all there is to it, Dinah said. And that is also how they crawl around on the ice without falling off. The minute hand on the clock began moving faster, and even the hour hand could be seen sweeping around now. The surface of the ice block became pitted, and then began to sink toward the floor as material was removed. But at the same time, one edge of the block developed a bulge that grew into a cantilevered prong, like the horn on an anvil.
What are they building?
Rhys asked. Doesn't matter. This is just a proof of concept. The growth stopped. The clock dial slowed to normal time. Another engineer walked in to snap some pictures of the result. Then the video cut away to a black screen.
Interesting, Rhys said.
She grabbed his hand before he could get away. Hang on. Check out the super-fast version. This started a moment later. It was just the same movie, shown 10 times faster. So it only lasted for a few seconds. The gnats were invisible because of the speed of their movement, just a jittery gray fog that came and went in patches. This drew the eye to the block of ice. Shown at this speed, it looked less like a crystalline slab and more like an amoeba, sinking down at one end while smoothly projecting a pseudopod into space.
One has to assume, Rhys said, that there's a reason why Sean Probst is so very keen on making ice sit up and do tricks for him.
Yeah, but he's not sharing it with me.
Is there any way, he wondered, of joining those gnats end to end?
Into a chain?
Yes, the Siwise are serviceable, but much more complicated than they need to be.
You have got chains on the brain. Yes, there's a way, and you can join them side by side to make a sheet.
Uncle John is calling to me from beyond the grave, telling me to make something of his hobby.
Well, stay in my good graces, she said, and I'll let you play with some. Day 56. As of A plus 0.56, the hub module around which the torus spun was no longer the aftmost part of Izzy. They called it H1 now. A larger hub, called H2, had been sent up on a heavy lift booster from Cape Canaveral and mated with it. H2 had originally been planned as the basis of a large space tourism operation. Rhys's original mission, for which he'd been planning and training for 2 years, had been to get that up and running. It had a new purpose now, of course, but functionally it would look the same. H2, the big central module, with a new and larger torus rotating around it. That new torus, inevitably called T2, was going to be assembled in space from a kit of rigid and inflatable parts, some of which had been shipped up packed inside of H2, others to follow later on subsequent launches. For the time being, H2 had 4 fat spokes extending from it to terminate in stubs where other parts, forming the rim of the wheel,
would be added later. The scouts by then had achieved their basic mission, which had been to employ the integrated truss assembly as a backbone to support a tree of hollow pipes, each about 50 centimeters in diameter, with wide spots every 10 meters or so. A human being, provided they were reasonably fit and did not suffer from claustrophobia, and did not have too much stuff in their pockets, could move through a tube of that diameter, somewhat like a hamster scurrying through a plastic tube in a cage. The wide spots were there so that two people going opposite directions could pass each other. Spherical modules served as connectors and branch points. The tubes terminated in docking locations, where spacecraft of various types could lock on to the space station and establish solid, airtight seals. For it had been obvious from the beginning that docking sites were going to be, in the lingo of Pete Starling, the scarce resource, the long pole, the critical path. Building rockets, spacecraft, and spacesuits was no easy matter, but at least these things happened on the ground, where colossal resources could be thrown into beefing up production. An armada of space capsules hurled into orbit would have nowhere to go, however, unless they could dock somewhere, and the docking sites had to be built the hard way, on site, in orbit. Docking was no joke, and required specific technology, but it was thoroughly understood, and it had been done many times. The Chinese space program had standardized on the same system used by the Russians, so their spacecraft, like the Russians, could dock at the ISS. So far, so good. But the fact remained that every manned spacecraft launched into orbit needed to reach a specific destination within a couple of days' time, before the occupants ran out of air, food, and water. The task of the scouts, therefore, had been to vastly increase the number of docks in the quickest and cheapest possible way. The docks couldn't be too close together, so the distances between them had to be spanned by hamster tubes. Bracketed to the outside surfaces of those tubes, and still being installed by fresh waves of scouts, were runs of plumbing and wiring and structural reinforcements tied into the adjacent trusses. The initial tube tree, built between about A plus 0.29 and A plus 0.50 by Tekla and the other first wave scouts, sported half a dozen docking locations. These were spoken for immediately by the first wave of so-called pioneer launches. Three Soyuz spacecraft, two Shenzhou, and a space tourism capsule from the United States. Encouraged by the success of the launch that had carried Bo and Reese, the Russians had found ways to cram five or six passengers on each Soyuz. The Shenzhou spacecraft was based on the Soyuz design, except larger and updated in various ways. Like the Soyuz, it was meant to carry a crew of three, but this was based on the assumption that those three would want to return to Earth alive. Modified for one-way trips, each Shenzhou carried half a dozen, and the American tourist capsule brought a complement of seven astronauts. So, all told, the first wave of pioneers brought three dozen people to Izzy, more than doubling its population. They were obliged to live in their space capsules, which had their own toilets, CO2 scrubbers, and heat rejection systems. This made for crowded conditions, but it was a step up from the Luke's. On A plus 0.56, when the H2 module came up on the giant Falcon Heavy rocket, Tekla and the other surviving scouts spent a day pulling out all that had been stuffed inside of it and anchoring it temporarily to the outside of the module. They then moved into H2, turning it into a scout dormitory and saying goodbye to their increasingly tatterdemalion Lukes, which were deflated, patched, folded up, and stored for later use in emergencies. About two-thirds of the pioneers had previous experience doing EVAs, or had been hastily trained over the last few weeks. There were not enough spacesuits to go around. These were being produced as fast as possible on the ground, but the existing ones could be shared. Work shifts were shortened from 15 to 12 hours, and then to 8, so that fresh bodies could be rotated through the available suits two or three times a day. The spacewalkers divided their time between assembling the T2 Taurus and extending the tube trees to provide docking space for the next wave of launches. The remaining pioneers, the non-spacewalkers, devoted themselves to other activities inside the pressurized parts of the space station. Dinah found herself with two assistants, Bo, who had seemingly assigned herself to the task, and Lars Hodemaker, the guy from the video. Lars was a young Dutchman who had been pursuing a graduate degree in robotics at Delft when he had been recruited by Arjuna Expeditions. Dinah knew him as a prolific email correspondent, always willing to answer her questions or supply code patches on short notice. Owing to some lapse in communications, she hadn't even known that he would be one of the passengers on the American tourist capsule that had arrived on day 52, for people were now dropping the A-plus notation and simply referring to days by their numbers. All she knew was that a large, strawberry blonde man suddenly appeared in her shop intent on hugging her. This was unusual. To put it mildly, the International Space Station, until now, had never been the kind of place for surprise visits. Lars had a fistful of chocolate bars in one hand and a camera in the other, and all manner of stuff was spilling out of the pockets of his coverall. Vials of morphine, antibiotics, reels of microchips on paper tape, disposable contact lenses, condoms, packets of dehydrated coffee, tubes of exotic lubricants, spare LEDs for mechanical pencils, bundles of zip ties. The policy now seemed to be that everyone being packed onto a ship first had to be so laden down with vitamins that they could hardly move. Lars was an enjoyable person, and his first day on Izzy was pure fun for Dinah, who had not been able to have a face-to-face conversation with a colleague in a year. She showed him around the shop, such as it was, and let him drive robots around on the surface of Amalthea, and brought a few of her grimmed robots in so that he could admire them. For, inspired by Reese's comment of a few weeks ago, Dinah had been putting her otherwise idle robots to work making armor for other robots. The orderly way to do it would have been to bring pieces of the asteroid back to her little zero-G smelter and produce nice little ingots of pure steel, then weld them onto the frames of the grabs. But this was making things too complicated. Amalthea was already made out of perfectly sound material. Maybe it was not structural-grade steel, but it was good enough to serve as radiation shielding. So she had just been slicing pieces of it off, leaving them in their original rough shape, and armoring grabs with overlapping plates of the stuff. They looked like walking asteroids now.
"It is an art project," Lars said.
For a moment, she thought he was trying to insult her, because she had met a few engineers in her day who never would have combined art and engineering. But his face was happy and guileless, and it was clear that he was paying her a compliment. Once she had gotten a bit used to him, she broached the subject that had been on her mind now for several weeks. Why ice? Given that they had direct access to a giant chunk of iron, why was Arjuna now putting all of its efforts into working with a material that, for all practical purposes, didn't exist on Izzy?
"Some things are not always explained to me," Lars said. "But you know that we have talked for some time about going after a comet core."
"Sure," Dinah said. "We've talked about it. But those things are huge. What are we going to do with a few gigatons of water?" Lars just blinked and looked mildly uneasy. "It would take forever to move something that big," Dinah said. "It's like a 10- or 20-year project. We don't have that much time."
"Under the old conditions? Yes."
"What do you mean, the old conditions?"
"Back in the day, before the agent, when we talked about moving comets, we were talking about sending up a big mirror, focusing the sun's light on the comet core, boiling off a little water, pushing it slowly to a new trajectory. Yes, that would take a long time, like pushing a bowling ball with a feather."
"And what about that has changed?"
Dinah asked. Physics is physics.
Yes, Lars said. And some physics is nuclear physics.
We're going to use nukes? I thought that was... Jesus! I don't even...
You don't appreciate how much things have changed down there,
Lars said. I guess not.
The architects came out and said, listen, there is no way of making this work with solar cells. We can't make them big enough, fast enough for thousands of outlets. They are big and cumbersome.
I'd been wondering about that.
They have to use nukes, is what they said.
RTGs?
Radioisotope thermoelectric generators were the power units used to run most space probes. At the heart of each was a puck of an isotope so radioactive that it remained hot for decades. Energy could be extracted from that heat in various ways.
Those are not nearly powerful enough,
Lars said.
Lars got messages from the ground in the form of encrypted email, a spate of capital letters in groups of five that looked like something straight out of an Enigma message. In the big nylon wallet that, for Lars, passed as a briefcase, was a stack of pages. On each of these was printed a different grid of random capital letters. About half an hour of laborious pencil and paperwork went into decrypting each message. Dinah couldn't believe her eyes. People used crypto all the time to send email, of course, and it was standard practice for all Arjuna Expedition's email to be enciphered. But apparently, that was no longer good enough for Sean Probst. Dinah got used to seeing Lars toiling over the sheets. He wrote out a little Python script to make it easier, but he still wrote the messages out by hand. One day, 2 weeks after he'd arrived, he decrypted a message with some surprising news. The boss was coming, as in, Sean Probst, the founder and CEO of Arjuna Expeditions.
How can that even happen? Dinah asked. How can anyone just come up to Izzy? Don't you need a launch vehicle? A spacecraft? A place to dock it? Permission?
These were largely rhetorical questions. Sean had made $7 billion from an internet startup before throwing his energies into asteroid mining. Along the way, he'd sunk a billion or two into other private space startups.
"He's coming up alone," Lars said, "in a drop-top."
It took Dinah a moment and a quick Google search to access the memory. Also referred to as the convertible, the drop-top was one of the more creative recent approaches to space tourism. It was based on the idea that what tourists really wanted to experience was the direct view of the Earth, the stars, and until it had ceased to exist, the moon. Conventional space capsules had tiny windows. What you really wanted to do was stick your head into a transparent bubble so you could enjoy a clear view out in all directions. In other words, you wanted to be in a spacesuit, basically floating free in space. The drop top was a small, simple capsule, capable of carrying four astronauts, dressed in custom-made spacesuits with bubble helmets. During the ascent through the atmosphere and the reentry, they were protected by a sturdy aeroshell. But while they were orbiting the Earth, the shell retracted, like the roof of a convertible, exposing them completely to space and even giving them some freedom to spacewalk.
"I don't think a drop top can reach an orbit this high, can it?"
Dinah asked.
"Sean's coming up alone. It is some kind of special one-passenger model. The extra mass is being used for propellant."
"And then what? It just goes to an airlock and knocks on the door?"
"Basically, yes," Lars said. "What will they do? Tell him to go away?"
Day 68.
"This whole thing is bullshit,"
said Sean Probst as soon as he got his helmet off. Dinah smiled. It was not that she was happy about the bullshit. When it came to preserving the human race and the genetic heritage of the Earth from destruction, any whiff of bullshit was bad. But she did feel a certain sense of relief.
In the back of her mind, she had been quietly tallying up the BS for weeks now. No one else here would speak of it, and most of them seemed smarter, better informed than she was. She knew Sean Probst by his reputation, by his signature on her paychecks, and by the emails he sent her at 3 o'clock in the morning of whatever time zone his private jet had most recently taken him to. Sean yielded to no one in his knowledge of all things space-related. When he walked into a space station and called bullshit, things were about to become entertaining. One of the few appealing things about him was that he had figured out that his personality was a problem and, in classic get-it-done style, had hired a coach to make him less of an asshole. She could see that working in his face.
"Not your part of it. That's awesome,"
he admitted. "I figured you would have said something earlier if that were not the case," Dinah said. Sean nodded. Done. His arrival at the space station had been unconventional and roundabout. There was no docking station to accommodate the drop top. There couldn't possibly be, since the drop top didn't even have a port or an airlock. So there'd been no way to attach it to Izzy. He had brought the little convertible in under manual control, tapping the thrusters one at a time, spitting bullets of spent propellant into space, then pausing for 1, 5, or 10 minutes to ponder the consequences. Space nerd that he was, he knew perfectly well that orbital mechanics did not obey the rules of earthbound physics. He had enough humility and enough spare oxygen to take it slow. Eventually, he had drifted close enough to Amalthea that a 3-Psi-Y train with a grab on its head had been able to reach out and grapple a fitting on the edge of his cockpit. He had then ejected himself from the vehicle, floating free in space, and gone on a little tour of inspection, firing off occasional messages to Dinah so that she could know where he was. Since there was no direct radio connection, these had to be relayed through a server in Seattle. He was in a tube suit, a tourist product that in some ways was less capable, in other ways more so, than the government-issue ones used by cosmonauts and astronauts. It had no legs at all, since legs were pretty useless in space. It looked like a test tube with a pair of arms and a bubble-shaped dome on the top. The arms had shoulder and elbow joints, but no hands as such. Gloves were notoriously the most troublesome parts of spacesuits. Instead, the tube suit's arms terminated in rounded-off stumps. Projecting from each of these was a skeletal hand consisting of a thumb and 3 fingers, actuated by steel cables that ran through airtight fittings into the arm stumps. The occupant could slip his hand into a glove-like contraption inside the stump that would pull on the metal tendons as he moved his fingers, thereby actuating the external digits and enabling him to grab things and perform a few simple operations. There was nothing about it that couldn't have been built by a tinkerer in an inventor's lab in 1890, or 1690 for that matter. People who had used them reported that they worked surprisingly well, better in some ways than conventional spacesuit gloves, which were stiff and fatigued the hands. There was plenty of extra room inside the stumps, and so when not using the claw-like hands, he could pull his fingers free of the internal glove and let them rest on internal touchpads and joysticks where he could type and swipe to his heart's content. The suit had some tiny thrusters that enabled the user to fly it around. Sean had put these to work at some length, wandering around the outside of Izzy and inspecting the work of the robots, the modifications made to the truss, and other curiosities. Finally, he found his way to an airlock at the aft end of H2 where Dinah had let him in, and he had blurted out his opinion. He looked like any nondescript 38-year-old nerd at a graduate physics seminar or a sci-fi convention, with stringy dishwater blonde hair stuck to his head by sweat and a few days darker stubble. In his official photos, he wore contacts. But today he wore thick-lensed eyeglasses. He pulled one arm, then the other, out of the suit, and then pushed himself up and out through the big opening at its top where the head dome had been attached. "I've been having trouble seeing the long-term sustainability angle," Dinah admitted, for she was not above dangling bait.
You think?
He shouted.
Has anyone done even the most basic mass balance calculation on this cloud arc concept?
Sean was from New Jersey. She wasn't sure what he meant, so she stalled for time. People have been pretty distracted. I wouldn't be the first to know.
They wouldn't tell you, he shouted, because you would see right away that it is bullshit.
What is? Ivy asked, floating toward them with an interested look on her face. And who the hell are you? Before Sean could explain who the hell he was distracted, to put it mildly, by the appearance of a 6-foot-tall Amazon with a shaved head and prominent facial scars, headed for him across H2 as if she had been launched out of a cannon. Tekla drove her shoulder into Sean's midsection, slamming him back against a bulkhead. A moment later, she was on him. She grabbed an outstretched arm and put Sean into a joint lock that looked pretty much inescapable. By now, Dinah had spent enough time with Tekla to know that she was a practitioner of Sambo, a Soviet combat martial art with many similarities to jiu-jitsu. Out of idle curiosity, Dinah had watched a few YouTube videos featuring Sambo practitioners in action, but she had never imagined, until now, that it could be done in zero gravity. Sean had made his entry through H2 because it had a useful assortment of airlocks and docking ports on its aft end. But unbeknownst to him, H2 had been doing double duty as the dormitory where the surviving scouts lived. His arrival had awoken Tekla, who was off shift at the moment and had been sleeping in her bag. Dinah tried to imagine what this encounter must have looked like from Tekla's point of view. Sean's arrival was unannounced. Dinah herself hadn't really known when or whether he was going to arrive until the drop top had swum into view outside her little window. So, from Tekla's point of view, this guy was an intruder. And when she'd heard Ivy say, "Who the hell are you?" she had realized that his presence on Izzy was completely unauthorized. "Oh, this is awkward," Dinah said.
"Tap! Tap!"
Sean kept saying. He was slapping Tekla's leg with his free hand.
"Commander, would you like me to restrain him?" Tekla asked. "What are your orders?"
"He's not dangerous," Dinah put in.
"Let him go, Tekla," Ivy said. Somewhat reluctantly, Tekla relaxed her grip and allowed Sean to float free. He drifted away from her, sizing her up with a certain degree of bewilderment. "Sean," Dinah said, "you've already made Tekla's acquaintance. I would like you to meet Ivy Shao, commander of this installation. Ivy, say hello to Sean Probst."
"Hello, Sean Probst," Ivy said, then turned to look at Dinah. "Did you know he was coming?"
"I had heard rumors," Dinah said, "but I did not think them firm enough to distract you by repeating them. I am sorry."
Ivy looked at Sean long enough to make him uncomfortable. Tekla, hovering almost within reach, did much to help supply the hostile atmosphere that Dinah suspected Ivy was reaching for.
"The closest analogy in the law for what I am here is the captain of a ship," Ivy said. "Do you know the etiquette, Sean, for coming aboard a ship?"
Sean calculated.
"Commander Shao," he said, "I humbly and respectfully request permission to come aboard your ship."
"Permission granted," she said, "and welcome aboard."
"Thanks.
But..."
"Yes?"
"If anyone asks, you'll please tell them a little white lie, which is that you requested permission first and then came aboard."
"I'm happy to do that,"
he said. "Later on, we'll evolve some sort of common law, I guess. A constitution for this thing."
"People are working on that, actually,"
Sean offered. "That's nice. But right now, we have nothing of the sort, and so we have to be mindful."
"It is so noted,"
Sean said. "Now," Ivy said, "you were saying something about bullshit when I interrupted."
"Commander Shao,"
Sean said, "I have the utmost respect for your past accomplishments and for the work you have been doing."
"Do you hear a butt coming?" Ivy asked Dinah. "I hear a butt coming." Sean stopped.
Go on, Ivy said, for at the end of the day, to go on was what Sean wanted, so they might as well get it over with. He worked it out from first principles on the whiteboard in the banana. Beginning with the Tsiolkovsky equation, a simple exponential, he developed some simple estimates, which he then developed into an ironclad proof that the cloud arc was bullshit. Or at least it had been bullshit until he, Sean Probst, had shown up to address the problems he had noticed. Problems that could only be handled by him personally. It occurred to Dinah to ask herself whether Sean was really rich anymore. Rich people no longer kept their wealth in gold. Sean's wealth was in stock, mostly stock in his own companies. She hadn't been following the stock market since the Crater Lake announcement, but she'd heard that it had not so much crashed as basically ceased to exist. The whole concept of owning stock didn't really mean much anymore, at least if you thought of it as a store of value. But legal structures, police, government agencies, and so on, still existed and still enforced the law. The law stated that Sean, by virtue of majority ownership of Arjuna Expeditions, still controlled it. And through overlapping relationships with other space entrepreneurs, he still had enough pull to get himself launched to Izzy, so that counted as wealth of a sort. Having settled that in her mind, she focused her attention back on what Sean was saying.
Cloud Arc is distributed swarm. Fine, I get it. Sign me up. Much safer than putting all our eggs in one basket. What makes it safer? The arklets can maneuver out of the way of incoming rocks. Other advantages? They can pair up to make a bolo and spin around each other to make simulated gravity. Keeps people healthier and happier. How do they do this? By flying toward each other and grappling the tethers together. What happens when they want to break up the bolo and go solo? They decouple the tethers and go flying off in opposite directions, unless they use their engines to kill that centripetal motion. What do all of these activities have in common?
They had gotten used to Sean's habit of asking, then answering his own questions, so were caught off guard now that he actually seemed to be expecting an answer. Dinah and Ivy had been joined by Conrad Barth, the astronomer, Lars Herdemaker, and Zeke Peterson. The latter finally rose to the bait.
Use of the thrusters, he said.
Sean nodded.
And what happens when we are using the thrusters?
Dinah had an advantage, since she already knew that Sean was concerned about mass balance. We're dumping mass, in the form of used propellant.
We're dumping mass,
Sean said, nodding.
As soon as the cloud arc runs out of propellant, it loses the ability to do all of the things that make it a viable architecture for long-term survival. It becomes a big sitting duck.
He let them roll that around in their heads for a bit, then went on.
Mind you, almost everything else that we do up here can be done with minimal effect on mass balance. We can recycle our urine to make drinking water and our poo to make fertilizer. Very few of our activities involve just releasing mass into space in a way that we can't get it back. This is the exception. I have been ranting and raving about this ever since the idea of the Cloud Arc was announced. So far, all I get in return from the powers that be are vague answers and hand-wavy happy talk.
Ivy and Dinah looked at each other in a way that foretold a one-on-one after-meeting tequila session. So, Dinah thought. Ivy had been wondering about this, too, in the back of her mind. Worrying about it. Trying to read the tea leaves during those teleconferences down to the ground. It was something to do with Pete Starling, she now saw, which meant that it was somehow related to JBF. Zeke was one of those open-faced, basically optimistic team players one saw frequently in the junior officer ranks of the military.
This is so obvious in a way.
He pointed out.
They have to have thought of this.
Which was Zeke's way of saying, I'm sure that this is all being handled by people way above our pay grade.
You would think,
Sean said, nodding. Conrad shifted in his chair uneasily and thrust his bearded face into his hand.
Unlike Zeke, he was not the sort to place the sunniest interpretation on the problem.
If the world were run by scientists, engineers, Sean said, then this would be a no-brainer. We have to go get more mass. Stockpile it so we don't run out.
It's got to be water. You're talking about a comet core, Dinah said.
It's got to be water.
Sean agreed.
You can't make rocket fuel out of nickel. But with water, we can make hydrogen peroxide, a fine thruster propellant. We can split it into hydrogen and oxygen to run big engines.
I'm waiting for the other shoe to drop in what you just said, Ivy muttered. Then she spoke up more clearly.
But the world isn't run by scientists and engineers. Is that where you're going with this?
Sean turned his hands palm up and shrugged theatrically.
I'm not a people person. People keep telling me this. Some who are people persons might be focusing on that angle.
The people angle,
Conrad said, just clarifying.
Yeah, the 7 billion people angle. 7 billion who need to be kept happy and docile until the end. How do you do that? What's the best way to calm down a scared kid? Get them to go back to sleep? Tell them a story. Some shit about Jesus or whatever.
Zeke winced. Conrad rolled his eyes, then glanced at the ceiling and pretended he hadn't heard this. The idea Sean was playing with here was so monstrous in a way that it was almost inconceivable. That everything they were doing up here was a lullaby for the 7 billion down below. That it could not actually work. That they were just putting on a show of getting ready. That the people of the Cloud Ark would live only a few weeks longer than the ones left behind. As such, Ivy and Dinah and Conrad and Zeke ought to have been freaking out at this point. But none of them, not even Zeke, reacted very much.
You've all thought of it too,
Sean said.
Even an asshole like me can see it in your faces.
Okay, maybe we've all thought it, Dinah admitted. How could you not think it? But Sean, what you might not have seen, being based on the ground, is how serious everyone up here is about making this work. If it were just a Potemkin village, we'd be seeing different stuff. Sean held his hands up, palms out, placating her.
Can we just agree that there might be a range of views down on the ground? And that some people, perhaps highly placed, see its primary function as an opiate of the masses, like the video you pop into your car's DVD player to keep the kids quiet during a long drive.
People like that are not going to be our friends when it comes to getting the resources we need, Ivy said.
This strategy is always going to seem a little off-kilter, a little beside the point, opaque, frustrating.
They were definitely talking about Pete Starling. Sean continued.
To the extent that such people control launch sites and policy, we have a problem. Fortunately, they don't control everything.
They were now talking about Sean Probst and his loose circle of billionaire friends who knew how to make rockets.
There's a lot about this Cloud Ark thing that I and my associates don't know yet. We can't sit around waiting for perfect knowledge. We have to act immediately on long lead time work that addresses what we do know. And what we do know is that we need to bring water to the Cloud Ark. Physics and politics conspire to make it difficult to bring it up from the ground. Fortunately, I own an asteroid mining company. We have already identified some comet cores in easy-to-reach orbits. We're narrowing down the list, and we're preparing an expedition.
Conrad well understood the timing of such missions.
How long, Sean?
2 years,
Sean said. Well, Ivy said, I guess you'd better get on it then. How can we help?
Give me all of your robots,
Sean said. He turned to look at Dinah. Since we have declared open season on bullshit, Dinah began as soon as she had gotten Sean Probst alone in her shop. Sean held both of his hands up like a fugitive surrendering to the FBI.
Where would you like to begin?
You said that you have identified some comets, that you are narrowing down the list. That's crap. You wouldn't have come up here without a specific plan.
We're going after Greg Skeleton.
What?
Comet Grig Skellerup. Sorry, somebody's offspring called it Greg Skeleton and the name stuck.
Sean always referred to children as offspring. She'd heard of it.
How big is that?
2.5, 3 kilometers.
That's a lot of arclet fuel.
Sean nodded. He crossed his arms over his body and looked around the shop.
Hard to move something that big.
Still no answer.
You're going to jam a nuke into it and turn it into a rocket, aren't you?
He raised his eyebrows briefly. Since this was the only plausible way of moving something that huge, he didn't consider it worthy of an extended answer.
We got really lucky on the timing, he remarked.
You're going to fly a radioactive ice ball the size of the Death Star back here just as the shit is hitting the fan. Then what?
Dinah, I need to share something with you in confidence.
Well, it's about fucking time is all I can say.
Day 73. Doob had almost been to space once, about 10 years ago. An acquaintance of his, who had made a lot of money in hedge funds, had dropped $25 million on a 12-day trip to the International Space Station aboard a Soyuz capsule. It was traditional for the customer to designate a backup, a sort of understudy, who would take his place in the event of some illness or mishap. Since the backup might be swapped in at any time up to shortly before launch, they had to go through all the same training as the customer. And that was really the point, as far as the hedge fund man was concerned. An introvert, he needed someone who could act as a connection to the general public and put an appealing face on the whole thing. So he had selected Doc Dubois as his understudy. They'd set up a website and a blog and arranged for photographers to follow Dub's progress through the training program, with occasional glimpses of the hedge fund man in the background. In effect, Dub had acted as a publicity decoy. No one made any bones about this. Dub had been more than happy to do it. The training had been great fun. The hedge fund man had been generous in his spending on the website, and Dub had been able to produce a lot of good video explaining fun facts about spaceflight. And there had even been the small chance that he might go. A week before the scheduled launch, he had flown to Baikonur, bringing his wife and kids with him, video crew in tow. They had watched in a certain amount of amazement as the launch vehicle, a fan-tailed Soyuz FG, had been towed horizontally across the steppe on a special train, complete with smoke-belching locomotive, to the launch pad. And this really was little more than a pad. A concrete slab on the almost lunar surface of the Kazakh steppe, with a few pieces of apparatus around it to hoist the rocket up off the train and pump fluids into it. The contrast with the NASA way of doing things was stark to the point of being somewhat hilarious. Dub's youngest son, Henry, 11 years old at the time, had failed to pay attention to the elevation of the mighty rocket to its vertical position because he was distracted by the sight of a couple of stray dogs copulating 100 meters away from ground zero. The launch bunker, shockingly close to the pad, had a little vegetable patch out in front of it, where the technicians were growing cucumbers and tomatoes. They explained that the concrete wall soaked up sunlight during the day and helped keep the vegetables warm at night. 3 days before launch, the hedge fund man had been nipped by a stray dog while rehearsing a launch pad escape sequence, and everything had been thrown into disarray as the dog was chased across the steppe by militiamen in wheeled vehicles, locals on horseback, and a helicopter gunship. After they had run it to the ground, they had shipped it off to a veterinary lab to be checked for rabies. Only 3 hours before launch, word had come back that the dog was clean. Dube's name had been struck from the manifest and replaced by that of the hedge fund manager. Both relieved and disappointed, Dub had stood on terra firma, very close to the launch pad. Tavistock Prowse had come out to cover the launch. He had come equipped with all kinds of electronic gadgets that had seemed cool at the time. He had stood there on the step, facing Dub and the rocket, aiming a video camera at him and catching his narration as the giant vehicle had fired up its engines and hurled itself into the sky. More than anything else, that image had made Dr. Harris into Doc Dubois and launched his career. It had also led, within days, to divorce proceedings initiated by his wife. She had a number of complaints about his performance as a husband, many of long-standing, some that she could barely articulate. But somehow, all of them had been summed up and crystallized by the fact that, after largely ignoring his responsibilities as a husband and father for several weeks while training for this launch in Russia, he had spent the actual moment of launch not gathered in a safe place with his children, but outside, dangerously close to the rocket, with his bro Tav, ingratiating himself to millions of followers with excited and hilarious commentary. One way or another, Dube had been paying for it ever since, partly in the negative sense of suffering just penalties for his sins, but partly in the more positive sense of spending time with his kids when he could. And this had become more difficult as they had graduated from school and gone out into the world. He was making a particular effort to do it now that they were all under a death sentence. On A plus 0.73, Dube flew into Seattle, rented an SUV, and drove to the campus of the University of Washington. Along the way, he stopped at a couple of outdoor stores to pick up some camping equipment. This was now expensive. People had begun hoarding that sort of thing in anticipation of a collapse of civilization. But only a few people. Most understood that there was little point in taking to the hills when the hard rain began. Freeze-dried food and backpacking stoves were difficult to come by, but down sleeping bags and fancy tents were still in stock. Henry was now a junior in the computer science department, living with some of his friends near the campus in a rental house. A classic Seattle down-at-the-heels craftsman bungalow, half-digested by blackberries and English ivy. In a certain way, it made no sense anymore to speak of anyone as being a student at a particular stage in a degree program. And yet, people went on thinking this way, kind of in the way that someone who has just been diagnosed with a terminal illness will go on getting up and going to work every morning. Not so much out of habit, as because the knowledge of impending doom makes them wish to assert an identity. He was tempted to park the SUV illegally, since, according to his calculations, the authorities were not likely to catch up with him and demand payment of the parking ticket before the end of the world. But it seemed that most of the people of Seattle were still obeying the rules, and so he did likewise. He found Henry, all four of his housemates, and five other students all crammed into the ground floor of the bungalow, keeping it warm in the January chill with their body heat and the warmth emanating from a rat's nest of PCs, laptops, and routers. A quick census of empty pizza boxes suggested that they had been working all night. "I'll explain it to you while we drive," had been Henry's promise to his dad when Dube had asked him on the phone last night what he was doing. But this morning, other than getting up from his lazy boy to give his dad a hug and tell him, "I love you," he didn't have much more to say. Every parent of a teenager gets used to it, the moment in a child's life when he or she decides that certain facts are just too much trouble to explain to mom or dad. The parents can't and needn't know every last little thing. And they just have to accept this, be content with what they can glean on their own, and move on. Henry, of course, had passed through that veil some years ago. Dube had swallowed his pride and accepted it, as every parent must. It was part of growing up. But back in those days, the subject matter had been fundamentally uninteresting. The size of Henry's collection of Magic the Gathering cards, the weightlifting program assigned him by his football coach, and who had a crush on whom at school. It was easy for Dube to pretend he didn't care about that stuff. What he was seeing over the shoulders of the students in this room looked a good deal more interesting, and that, in a way, hurt. All of them, of course, knew that Henry was the son of the famous Doc Dubois. While trying to play it cool, they all sought a chance to shake his hand and say hi. Dube chewed the fat with them while his eyes strayed to the stuff they had blue-taped to the walls of the bungalow. Printouts of CAD drawings, schedule grids, Gantt charts, maps. He was obviously looking at some sort of engineering project in the works, but he couldn't make out what exactly. On the kitchen table, a MakerBot was producing a small plastic part, watched intently by a young woman who was talking on her phone in a mix of English and Mandarin. Conversation was interrupted by the beep, beep, beep of a backup alarm, loud and growing louder. Someone pulled the front door open, letting in a wash of wet, cool Pacific air to reveal a Ryder box truck backing up onto the lawn, heading straight for the front door. Some unkillable instinct in Dube's head made him glance disapprovingly at the muddy ruts it was leaving in the lawn, made him issue a little tut-tut-tut at these irresponsible youth for damaging the grass. Grass that in 2 years would be a thin smear of carbon black over a lifeless cake of hardened clay, presuming it didn't suffer a direct hit and become part of a huge glass-lined crater. The truck didn't stop soon enough and wrecked a wooden banister beside the front steps. Everyone laughed. The laughter had a curious tone, a mixture of childish delight with something darker, expectant of much worse to come. These kids were really adapting better than he was. He had no idea what was going on, but it seemed to involve